Talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I moderate this series with my colleague in the gray, Peggy Wright, with assistance from our website guru wandering around taking pictures, Hai Wan Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. Our technical specialist tonight is David Runner, the library's technology coordinator. The posters were designed by Daniel Peach. Our speaker tonight is a first-generation son of a French immigrant from Lyon, France. And after World War I, his father emigrated to an area near Harrods Creek and eventually obtained work as a timekeeper at the Uniontown Lock and Dam on the Ohio River near Uniontown, Kentucky. He later married a local girl, and here our speaker was born in 1944, and after completing his education, he found work with the Whirlpool Corporation in Evansville, Indiana. For the next 7 years, he worked for Whirlpool, interrupted briefly by a two-year stint in the U.S. Army, where he spent most of his time at Fort Hood and not in Vietnam. He began his career in the mines at the age of 29 in June of 1974, and he followed his younger brother Dan, who'd begun working for the Island Creek Coal Company in 1973. For the next 18 years, he held a variety of positions with the Peabody Coal Company, from shoveler to section foreman. Face Boss is his personal memoir of those years and one of the only memoirs ever written by an actual miner. Mike became a celebrity in Uniontown in November of 2007 when the University of Tennessee announced a plan to publish his manuscript. His goal, he said in an interview with the Henderson Gleaner, was to help preserve the record and culture of underground mining in western Kentucky. In addition to Face Boss, he's co-authored a book of his father's life, his father by the name of Anthony G. Gillerman, for his family, and keeps a journal of his life numbering now 2,800 pages. We're impressed. He resides in Uniontown with his wife Marie, 42 years. His son Dennis is a graduate of Western and here tonight. Welcome. Please give a warm welcome to Mike Gillerman. Mike.
I think I better leave now while I'm here. Well, and by the way, this is my first time. I've never done this before, and I have no training or experience in public speaking, so just bear with me, all right? I thought I would, rather than go right into the mining aspect of it, I thought I'd start off with a little bit of background and history of how this Peabody complex developed in Union County. So let's go to 1942, kind of the beginning stages of World War II, and at that time, the United States government came into the county and announced that they were going to build Camp Breckenridge there and that they would need 36,000 acres of prime farmland. Well, everyone was pretty much shocked. 8 days after this announcement, the government, or all these 1,500 farm families living on these 36,000 acres, received notices that they had to vacate their farms and land in 30 days. They gave them 30 days to leave. And that was it. There wasn't any recourse. You couldn't take it to court. They condemned the land. And they give them, I think, $84 per acre. So the farm families, they had to leave. And it run a lot of families. And in fact, my wife's grandmother had a farm there in Waver that had been in the family for 100 years. And she never recovered emotionally after the loss of their farm. So it was devastating for the farm families there in Union County. So after that happened, they did try to retain some of their mineral rights. Well, the federal government told them, well, the coal and oil there under those thousands of acres had nothing but a nuisance value. In other words, it wasn't even worth fooling with. Of course, they knew better. So they didn't get to retain mineral rights. They just lost it all. But they had one hope that someday they could come back when the military reservation closed and buy their land back. They were told that, but these land buyers are the ones that took the land. But they didn't have nothing in writing. It was all verbal. So anyway, the years passed by. The military comes in. It was a huge base. They had 30,000 American soldiers there that were training for war combat in Germany. And later they had 4,000 German prisoners of war there at the camp complex. And a lot of these soldiers worked on farms because a lot of the American boys were overseas fighting. So it was really something. It was a big boon for Union County. Even though it devastated farm families, it had an overall positive effect on the county because of the jobs and things like that created. So the years passed by, and in 1962, the Korean War now over, the government has no further need of Camp Breckenridge. So they're going to dispose of the property, so all the landowners say, terrific, we're going to get our farms back. Well, that didn't happen. When they took that land from the farmers, most of them were small farmers, nothing like today. You're just 100 or 150, maybe 200 acres. But when the government sold these plots, they sold them in 580-acre farms. Well, they couldn't afford to buy them back, so the highest bidder got the land, so very few got their land back. And as far as the mineral rights, forget that. So that same year that they sold the surface rights, the highest bidder, in these 585-acre plots, they also sold the mineral rights that they said earlier only had a nuisance value. Well, now, all of a sudden, it's extremely valuable. So TVA ended up getting the coal rights from the General Services Administration and kept the land for 4 years. I forget now exactly what they paid for it, but 4 years later, Peabody Coal Company was granted a contract for, I think, $84 per acre. Now, under this land that supposedly had no value, there was an estimated 120 million tons of coal in the number 9 seam and another 84 million tons in the number 11 vein. So, and plus, just millions of barrels of oil. And they're still pumping that oil today. And they just recently finished mining the coal. So those poor people, the farmer, they were really screwed over, and excuse me, pardon the language. And in fact, it's still in court to this day. It's still being battled, and you might read about it in the paper, the Breckenridge landowners and so on. And even went to the Supreme Court, I believe, and one of the judges ruled in favor of the landowners, but everything's still pending. So anyway, that's how these mines came about. The General Services Administration sold the land to the Tennessee Valley Authority, who in turn leased or sold the coal rights to Peabody Coal Company in 1969, okay? Peabody gave, I think they got they paid $54 per acre for the coal. Like it was like $1,680,000 for these 30-something thousand acres of coal rights. So anyway, in 1969, Peabody began building two huge underground coal mines on this land, Camp Number 1 and Camp Number 2, and 4 years later they developed Camp Number 11. But my whole career was spent in this mines that you see right here. Now this coal was considered really high quality coal. It was number 9 vein, and it was rated, it's like 12,500 BTU, British thermal units per pound. So it was high grade coal. Wyoming coal that you hear so much about now, even though it's low in sulfur, it's only rated at like 8,600 BTU. So they say it only has just a little over half the power energy potential of our bituminous coal there in Union County. So the downside, though, is, as we all know, sulfur dioxide. You know, our coal is Eastern coal or Illinois coal basin is considered moderate to high in sulfur dioxide. And the Clean Air Act only allows like 1.2 pounds per million BTU of coal burned. That's it. That's all they're allowed. One, two pounds without scrubbers. So any mines burning this high sulfur Eastern coal pretty well has to have scrubbers because. And we all know what's happening to, you know, the greenhouse gases, the melting of the global ice caps, and the glaciers in Montana, as close as Earth, say they're going to be gone in 25 years. So it is a serious thing, and even though I'm connected with the coal industry and have a lot of empathy for it, we can't destroy our atmosphere either, and I'm hoping that if there is such a thing as clean coal technology, they can figure out some way to use coal, keep the jobs, and to save our environment. I'm really hopeful because I just don't believe they can build enough windmills to supply the power needs of this country. I really don't. And by the way, 90% of our power here in Kentucky is generated by coal. So. But anyway, back to this coal mines here. This seam of coal is kind of like looking at an X-ray. What you see here is 350 feet below the surface of the earth. It's 350 feet down. And this coal seam is approximately 62 inches high. Is how thick this number 9 seam is. And as noted, it's a high-grade coal with a lot of BTU content. And it's a big mine. This mine's here, when it was mined out in 1992, covered approximately 11 square miles. That's how big it was. And you know, there's like 640 acres in one square mile, so you can do the math to see how big that it really was. Okay, if you break it down a little further, 1 acre of this coal weighed almost 9,000 tons, just 1 acre of it. So, so anyway, it was a big mines and a productive mines, and over this 20-year operation, I think we mined like 32 million tons of coal during this year's operation. But okay, I started working there in 1974 as a general inside laborer, and 5 years later I was promoted to section foreman. And so my whole career was kind of unusual. It was spent in this one mine, so I know it pretty daggone well. And when I first started, I don't know how many of you have read my book, but when I first started bossing, I was bossing on this number 6 unit here. That's when I first started. It was tough back then. Bosses, I mean, it was a UMWA mine. I was a UMWA miner for 5 years before I took the company job. But it was tough. I mean, you know, you had the union on one side, and you had your bosses on the other side, and you had to be productive, you had to be safe, and it was a tough environment. But right after I was wormy, I had a lot of energy. All right, after you go cutting, you better, you won't keep a job. So anyway, I had this crew of men. It was a pretty good crew, and I was in the early 30s now, proud of my new job as a face boss. And back then, overtime was, well, just all you wanted. A guy wanted to work double shifts, whatever, it was available. But if sometimes the union and the company got into a spat, well, they would shut off the overtime. No more overtime. Well, boy, that would really rile up the union, man. They would bull, which is slow walk. In other words, everything was done in slow motion. Your tonnage production would be cut in half what it normally was. So it was tough, especially on a new boss like me. So anyway, this loader operator, which I'm going to explain all that in a minute. It was a conventional unit. I need to get to that pretty soon. But my loader operator, which was a key position, he operated this machine that loaded coal into the shuttle cars. But he was from Oklahoma, and he was a super Marlboro man, if you know what I mean. He was in his 50s at the time, and had a broad shoulders and a 20-inch neck and cowboy boots, the big buckle, a plaid shirt, and white hair cast. He's a tough dude. So anyway, our production had slowed down, and so I asked my assistant mine foreman, my boss, who knew this guy very well, and he said, "What do you think I'll do about this problem I'm having?" He said, "Why don't you meet Ed out in the parking lot and ask him what his problem is?" I guess I was gullible. So, after his second shift, that night I was filling my books out, kind of watching out the door there, and there goes Ed out toward his truck. You know, "Hey, Ed, can I speak to you a minute?" "Well, sure." So here he is, you know, it's his cowboy, white cowboy hat, and a mouth full of beach nut chew in the back. And I walked up to him, and I already knew I screwed up. I said, "Could I talk to you about a production problem on the unit?" And boy, as those words started slipping my mouth, his demeanor changed. And I believe Rambo would have went and said, "Thank you." So, boy, he took that big finger, it looked like a baseball mitt, and started poking me, and I pushed me back. "Boy, don't you try to put the monkey on my back." And I said, It wasn't my intention when he walked off and spinning gravel with the cowboy boots. But I never forgot that. But, you know, the company, they started the overtime back up, so everything got better. But that's how it was down there. And it was just touch and go. You just never knew what to expect. It was, and in my book, I referred to this area, some of you might remember, I referred to it as the Wild West. So that was all of these panels. These, by the way, are panels. It was all this area here, and I'll just tell you another little incident before I get into the equipment, but this is where we came into the mines. This is where the bathhouse was, and the slope was 1,600 feet long, the 16-degree angle, so it's pretty steep. We'd come in here, and you'd follow these, track systems. It just took forever to, move these old rough tracks. To get there, and we used mantras for a while, and it kept breaking down. So management decided they would use what we call a mule train. It was like just several flatbed cars, open cars, pulled by an electric motor, the same thing as like a diesel motor, a locomotive. And you would have one on the front of the train and one on the back as a brake motor. So at the beginning of the shift, we had all loaded into that mule train, probably 60 of us, just like sardines. And you had a trolley bar, that's how everything was powered. And you didn't want to get under this. So I had a little bar there to keep that from happening. But most of the miners back then, and I kind of failed to mention that in my book, but the miners at that time were young guys. All the veteran miners had been hired at Camp One, and because their mines were just a little ahead of ours. So a lot of us guys were just like me, right off the street. So we didn't know a lot about coal mining. And they were young. They were 18, 19-year-olds and a lot of 20-year-olds. And that at that age, you got a lot of energy and a lot of vinegar. So anyway, these guys on the way to unit, they liked to play. Kids liked to play. I mean, they've got kids. And one of them would throw something at one another, a rock or water or something, or rock dust, and get into one heck of a brawl. And the time we'd get here to let number 8 unit off, well, they'd be scuffling with like men on number 6 unit. And this, they would really be doing some, it wouldn't play, it was really fighting. And they would jump off these mantrets, cars, and just fighting, bodies going everywhere, and cuts and bruises and scrapes, and they would last 20 minutes, just get completely beat up and worn out. And if you didn't get off and help your unit buddies, just wait till you got to the unit. You'd wished you had. So you had to fight. You had to join in. But I described this in the book. I never was much of a fighter. I was a little older, 4 or 5 years older. I didn't fight and all that stuff. But you had to on occasion to survive. But I remember this one occasion. I would think I was on number 8 unit. And I got off and we were all fighting, pushing and shoving. And I looked up and here comes this big guy looking like a football player. He was probably about 20 years of age. Like I say, I was about maybe 31. He come charging me like a bull. Said, oh my goodness. I'm going to get hurt. So I, from watching movies, I said, I need to try something different. So when he got really close to me, I reached out and I grabbed his hands. And I immediately fell on my back, jammed my mining boots into his stomach. Did him a big somersault right over my head. It was perfect. Perfect. And he hit so hard, he weighed about 240 pounds, it knocked the air out of him. He couldn't breathe. So, boy, I jumped on it and pinned. But that really made me feel good. But that's the way it was back in those days, especially from 1974 up until 1982 when we had the first big mine layoff. At that time, a lot of these younger miners lost their jobs. So the horseplay slowed down after that, but it was really, and a lot, really tough. And other things I describe, I can't discuss here. It's a little too tough, some of the initiations and things like that I better not discuss, but it was all a tough world down there. But after we finished mining this panel here, we moved down here on the main line track. Yeah, this was called the 6th East. 6th East, 7th East, 8th East, and this is driving toward the east side. You might not believe this, but right here is 8 miles. That's how vast that really is. 1 inch on here represents 400 feet, linear feet. So it's huge, 11 to 12 square miles. So you're talking about a vast, vast area, like 8,000 acres. here. But anyway, we moved into this panel here. And of all my years of bossing, like 12 and a half years, this was the pits. It couldn't get any worse than what I went through. And when I was writing the book, I still hurt to write about it. It was tough. I had a lot of young miners, buddies, banded together and drinking. They weren't bad miners, they weren't really bad guys or anything like that. They just wanted to control the unit and do things the way they wanted to do, not the way I wanted to do. And I was the boss, and I was wanting to suffer the repercussions if things didn't go right. The superintendent wouldn't come after them because, I was the boss. So that was a really tough period. But fortunately, a little later, a few months later, I mean, we run decent coal. I kept a pretty good unit. It was just misery. If you've ever been in that kind of situation, just hate going to work. But that was the only period in my mining career that I hated going to work, was not having that crew there. But eventually, the boss driving, these are called mains. This is a panel. Just go in and get all the coal you can. These mains are the lifeblood of the mine. They're also called headings. You drive usually 9 entries, and this is the unit that sets up all these panels to follow, to run coal. Well, the boss running these mains at the time wasn't doing his job. He wasn't very conscientious. He wasn't running his sights to keep the entries straight. He wasn't clean. And I had a reputation of being a really clean boss. I was keeping a clean unit, keeping the entries in the line, et cetera. I really cared about my job. So they swapped us. As far as I'm concerned, the best thing could ever happen to me. So anyway, they put me on this number 5 unit. I was on that unit a couple of years. That was the best years of my career at camp, too. I had a terrific crew, and it was a joy just about every day to go to work. Well, this poor boss who got this, it wasn't my fault, he just wasn't doing his job. Well, they fired him for drinking. He got the stress, got to be too much with that crew. And one night before a Christmas holiday, they got complete. They just got complete. They took over. That's what they wanted to do with me. You don't know what a man trip is. It's a track vehicle, but it's not meant to run on supply roads. It has to be on tracks. Well, they took a Jeep. Well, that's like a locomotive, and drug it off the track on its steel wheels and drug it to their unit, so that they could sneak out early that night. The whole unit, like 10:30, and shift unit at 12, and plus they brought a couple of cases of beer underground. That's a big no-no. So anyway, the poor guy, he's a good guy. He just relinquished control, and they took advantage of him, so they ended up firing him. But that particular night, I never forgot it. At the end of that shift that night, they drug that man trip to the unit. I mean, that was a wild bunch of them. I was coming through Morganfield that night. And by the way, now I started drinking a little bit myself from all the stress. I'd carry a six-pack to work on second shift, and I'd drink a beer or two on the way home, and sometimes 6. It just depends. And then the guys take the lease. They didn't force drinking and driving like they do now. You couldn't get away with that now, but back then it wasn't such a big problem. I didn't get really intoxicated. I guess I got a little buzz, but it seemed to help at the time. But that particular night, I drove into Morganfield, and here's number 6 unit roaming around in their cars. I had to see me in my little Toyota. Whoa. I thought, well, here we go. Try to beat me up. And got out of my truck, but I was, I'd done had a beer. And I was wanting a little payback. So this one guy come at me. Cussing, slang. All right, I want to get one good shot in it before I go down. But that's all he was. He was just mouthing. So nothing happened after he finished. I finished. Well, he went on to Shawnee Town. But a few weeks later, on the shift, we were short-handed another holiday, and I had a short crew. A lot of people on weekends, and the miners would use sick days to have like a 3-day weekend. Really common. So I got two key positions from this old 6 unit, the cutter and the drill operator. They were only running about 20 minutes, and they tore their equipment all to pieces. It was down the rest of the ship. Anyway, that's the way it was, but it doesn't sound like a person could enjoy that, but there was a a lot of camaraderie down there, and the guys, most of the miners are miners because they like being miners. Of course, the pay was really good at that time, and the benefits before the UMWA lost their health card. This health card, it would just pay for everything, but they lost that later in contract negotiations. So it was a good place to work, and I have no regrets working there. It was pretty hard on me physically, but it was a good mine. Had a lot of good bosses. Of course, had a lot of bad bosses too. It was okay after when I think about it. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, because I knew these hundreds of miners, and that's why there's so many names in my book, because I did know a lot of them after, you know, nearly 18 years there, and I just didn't want them to be forgotten. Like, there's a lot of them now, even the pictures in that book, a lot of them are gone, they've died. So I just wanted them to live on, you know, if possible, somewhere. Another reason that I wanted to do this. So that's pretty much it as far as the mines. You know, it's like 11 square miles. It's 333 feet on average below the surface. This is no just, and I don't have the other map. This is just the number 9 vein. Above this vein was a number 11 vein. It was 80 foot higher, okay? But the number 11 vein of coal is not nearly quality-wise as good as our number 9 vein, because it has a lot of reject. And you know, you see these and read about these gob piles. Well, that's reject that's washed out of the coal, because number 11 is seen as embedded with coal, or excuse me, with rock, an extraneous material that won't burn. It has to be washed out, ash, things like that. So I always preferred the number 9 vein. So when you take that into consideration, 12, 13, almost 15 square miles that was mined there, close to 9,000 acres of coal. So, any questions so far?
How long a time, a period, is one shift?
8 hours.
So you're underground straight away for 8 hours?
Yes, at that time, things have changed. When I was there, it was 8 hours. That was from portal to portal. In other words, here's your portal. When they're miners, just say 7 o'clock, that's when your shift started. It might take you an hour to get to here. But you know, the clock was ticking. I mean, it was on company time till you got there. And then another hour to get out the end of the shift. So, it was an 8 hour shift. Now later, they put an air shaft right here. An air shaft too, to save travel time, because that was critical, because you just lost so much time getting to and from the unit, these old man trips, mule trains. Because these old tracks, I mean, you just wouldn't leave some of the roof conditions. I mean, you drive riding down through there on this man trip, you got these steel rail bars, like railroad track, to hold the roof up, and they'll be swagged, and you just got just enough clearance to get under them, you know. But you get used to that, and after a while, it doesn't bother you anymore. But for the uninitiated, it was scary. I mean, I took my brother and a brother-in-law down there, and I said, no way will I ever get back. So, 8 hours. It might be a little different now, but that's the way it was then.
The accident level? Accidents.
There was a lot of accidents. Most of them.
Do you have underground care for that?
No. And you were hurt, you go outside.
So it'd take you another hour and a half, you could be dead by the time you get out.
You could. I was knocked unconscious 3 different times. Had to be taken out. But no, there was no treatment. I mean, you had first aid kits. We had splints, things like that, backboards and stuff. But we did have a few EMTs, things like that. But no, if you were hurt and just get outside. And another thing about this mines, we were in extremely hazardous top. Now, I didn't mention this earlier, but this is former Camp Breckenridge, and our particular mines was an impact area for the artillery range. So you can imagine all over here, boom, boom, shaking that daggone roof. So that didn't help. And also, all of you know what a fault line, like the New Madrid fault, you've heard of that. But the Rough Creek fall system It was another major fault line was right nearby this, so that didn't help our top either, our roof. And our roof was a slate. We had a slate roof and a number 9 seam, and a lot of the fingers, our rifts, shot off of this major fault line, which kind of run parallel with Highway 56. And they would run, these little fingers would run throughout some of these coatings, panels. And when you hit a fault, in other words, you just, like this is a solid seam of coal, it just disappears. It's nothing but rock. The coal seam is usually down below, or it could be up there several feet. And you just can't hardly mine through all that rock and fire clay to get to it, so you just have to stop advancing and then pull out and set up somewhere else. That happened a lot because of that Rough Creek fault system, which is a major fault system. So, and by the way, I think it's been a footnote, but another mine's in a neighboring county there, that same fault system, they run into this Rough Creek fault system. And, of course, when you have a fault, the platelets, earth platelets break, separate like this or whatever. Well, this other coal company had one of the Pyro non-union mines. They run into this fault, and it dropped at a 4% grade. When they started out, I think I was told they had a 250% overburden, which is the coal seam to the surface. When they got to the bottom, it was 1,000 feet. But this coal seam was going like this. And they just kept mining down at a 3 to 4% grade all the way. So that's amazing. I can imagine that equipment trying to pull that grade going back up the belt. I can't even visualize. So, and by the way, I might be able to do that on another little sketch there. You see all these little, like a checkerboard, all these little blocks? This is something very important I didn't mention. They are pillars of coal that are left to hold the roof up, okay? This is coal that's left, so when you go in there and mine this coal, you're only recovering 50% of it. Half of it's still there to support the roof. It seems like such a waste. Eastern Kentucky, they pull these pillars. They call it retreat mining. Just like this panel here, they'd start right here. After they mined this panel out, they would start here and start going backwards, pulling the coal pillars, which is extremely dangerous, because when you pull these pillars, everything's coming in. It's like a longwall unit. It all falls in. But we don't do that here in Western Kentucky, as far as I know. So that's something to keep in mind, too. But of all this coal, this 9,000 tons per acre, you're only going to recover 50% of it at the most. In this room and pillar mining, which is a standard type of mining throughout this part of the United States, if it's not a longwall. And then, we used to use conventional equipment, which I hope to get to in a minute. They switched over to continuous miners. Of course, I think all of you know what a continuous miner is. It replaced the cutter, the loader, the drill, and the shooter on the conventional unit, which is great, big plus. Plus, they were much safer, not near as much dust anymore with continuous miners. But one of the drawbacks was extraneous material. A continuous miner with that big ripper head cuts up a lot more fire clay bottom. They cut more top down, so you have a lot more reject. Our coal back in the 70s and 80s, before we got continuous miner, they didn't even have to wash it because it was pretty well pure coal. You'd get a little fire clay bottom, a little draw slate, but basically it was all coal. They didn't even wash it. But when they brought them miners in there, it was all the difference in the world. It had to be washed. So of that 9,000, just say an acre of 9,000 ton, well, you lost half of it for pillars and bearing pillars and things like this, so that's 4,500. You probably lost another 10,000 or another 1,000 tons to reject. So you might end up with 3,500 tons out of that 9,000 tons, saleable tons that could actually be recovered and sold. So There's a lot of loss there, and there's no way to ever go back and get it either, because I imagine it's all fell in by now. I'm sure it is. The way we secured this top was with, sorry. The way we secured this top was with roof bolts or roof pins. So they were normally 4 foot in length, about 3/4 inch diameter, and they had ribs on it. And what they would do, they would place this, roof bolter, would drill a hole into the mine roof 4 feet deep. They would stick a 4 foot stick of resin glue. You stick the glue up, then you stick the steel pin in behind it, then take the boom, pick it up, start spinning it, and it would mix that resin glue, and it would harden in just a couple of seconds. And when it did, it had, you wouldn't believe, a holding pattern of resin bolt glue, and that kind of saved our minds, because before then, they were using conventional pins, and they just weren't doing the job. So, any more questions right now? I'm sorry.
You sort of answered mine, but was that the only entrance? That's the only entrance?
Right here, all the coal mine, and there's 20 years right here, came out of this smoke. Because that's where the belt line went. Like I say, it was eight miles away when we were up to here as far as panel is. 8 miles, so it took a long time for that coal. They built all these various belt lines to get outside. Now later, they put a man shed, an elevator right here. And a lot of the men on the east side, that's how they came in. Of course, the coal couldn't go out, but the men, it was a lot safer because the elevators were quick. You could get on those and drop the bottom 330 feet in just a few seconds, it seemed. And back out, somebody would get hurt. It was just so much safer. You know, over on this old side, it was totally different. You get the bottom, and you'd have to get on the slope of the dolly to get outside, and that took several minutes up the long slope. And in the wintertime, there's icicles better than me. It was just bitter cold because the huge exhaust fan, and there's so much I could talk about. I forgot about, the air. I mean, to ventilate mines is just, you wouldn't believe it. You can imagine complexly, every unit here had to have like 12,000 cubic feet of air at their face to mine coal legally. So it was really intricate, the brandishes and airlocks and overcast. To get that air to all these working faces, it's just so much. I could go on and on forever about this.
How would you account for the safety of the individuals who, now if 60 of you came down in the little cart?
The mule train, yeah.
So how do you keep tabs? So because everybody's not working in the same place. Yeah. How do you assure the fact that everybody's out?
Well, we had a board outside, and you had these little tags you put on the board. Anytime you was on the ground, when you come out, you remove the little brass tag, and it was extremely important. So that's how they knew at the end of the shift, if anybody's on the ground, if his tag was still on the board, either he forgot to remove it, which happened, or he was still on the ground, and sent somebody down there to find him.
Did you have to go down and find him?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you couldn't account, I had to do that once out. A young kid, I got it. He just careless, didn't care, and come out and took off and left his tag hanging. I couldn't find him. Nobody seen him, so I had to go back underground. It took me about 2 hours of searching. Didn't find him. Finally, I think somebody said, well, he's already gone. Boy, I was hot. I had to walk out miles. And it's not easy walking down there either. A lot of times you walk all bent over. So I was pretty upset with that. But each crew, you have, like, our mines had 8 units. 8 crews of men mining the coal they're also called sections. I was a section foreman, face boss, it's all the same thing. A unit or a section, it's just all the same thing. And back when they were conventional units, you had up to 15 men, and each boss, you accounted for your men, you knew where they were. You took care of them. And then you had your track bosses, they had their crews. You had ventilation bosses. Timber bosses, they all had their crews, and they took care of their men. They paid them. They knew where they were at all times.
Were you given any kind of breathing equipment to go down there? No.
You were given dust masks. Yeah, but I bet 1%. Nobody used dust masks.
So what's the percentage of black lung? 100?
I couldn't care of that. But even in the early days, when I was back in the early 70s, these joy loaders were set up with water sprays, but just wasn't a macho thing to do. You just went there and got that coal. And very few would ever hook up the water hose to them, even though they were equipped with sprays. That's just the way it was. If you wanted a dust mask, you could get one every day, but I can't hardly remember one or two guys wearing masks, and one of them only because he had an allergy that he had to wear. just didn't do it. Now, we had breathing apparatuses in case of a mine fire or smoke, SCSRs, you know, self-rescuers. We did have those, and only for emergency. Heavy smoke. I've had to use them a couple of times. Unfortunately, you know, we had a huge mine fire there in 1984, lasted for 3 months. Nobody was hurt. And we had a methane ignition. That wasn't good, but nobody was killed. But two guys were burned. It was my unit on the opposite shift. I'll never forget that day because I set a record that day, the most tons ever run at Camp 2 with my conventional crew, okay? We run almost 1,200 tons. An 8-hour shift, which was almost unheard of. 900 tons is really exceptional. We just had the perfect storm. We really run the coal, but we were running so much coal on that conventional unit. We were the last conventional unit running at Camp 2. Everybody else had switched over to continuous miners, and we had this extra incentive to try to outrun them. You know, that's just the way it was. You know, you wanted to beat the other guy. So we really busted. But that day we run all this tonnage, and my buddy that night, my counterpart on second shift, he saw how much tons I run, so I guess he's going to try to match it. And so I think 7 o'clock that night, he was running three ways, which was shooting three faces at one time. He had some curtains down, the methane built up, and they had a methane ignition in one of these faces here. But anyway, they had a methane ignition. When it exploded, the loader operator, he was up in here, and the shuttle car was behind him. And that flame come out, and thank goodness it was rock dust. And of course, the methane burns at 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. And it come out, and luckily, and it self-extinguished, and come back, fired up again, and fired back again, twice. And the loader operator was wearing a nylon shirt, and melted it to the skin. Completely. Just like that, burned all the skin off of his face. The other guy burned his hands. But thank God it didn't pick up any coal dust, which usually the reason mine explosions can be so devastating, it's not so much the methane. It's, you know, you have your ignition, okay, it'll set this gas off. 1,200 degree Fahrenheit, highly explosive, 5 to 12%. But what it does, when it boom, blows, it picks up coal dust. You know, so here, and this is instantaneous, and then you got all this dust in the air, and it ignites the dust. This was terrible. It just starts rolling, and I'm talking about thousands of feet per second. It just picks up steam like a barrel of shotgun. You fire it, it's all. It actually forced. It didn't even blow equipment out the slope miles away. It's happened. This blew 40,000 pound cutter machines out the slope of the mine. I mean, you can't believe it would be possible, but it's happened. That's how violent some of these gas explosions, methane explosions you've heard about, a lot of it could be attributed to coal dust. You know, methane was the initial. I mean, that's what caused it, the spark setting off this methane. But then it picked up the coal dust, and that's why the mines, these federal and state inspectors, they originally enforced rock dust, which is ground up limestone. 65% of all extraneous material on all the coal ribs within 40 feet of the face, I mean out by, has to be 65% rock dust. In other words, it won't explode. You know, rock dust won't burn. And that's the reason why, to stop these methane or terrible explosions. So had that unit not been well rock dusted, no telling what could have happened. No, there's no telling. So that was the only major ignition we had there. Now my wife's nephew was killed at Pyro. I think in 1985, Pyro had a terrible methane explosion there, and it killed 10 miners. Moving along, on third shift, there was 14 men. This horrible explosion and killed 10 of them instantly. And there was actually 4 survivors. I don't know how they got out of there. It was probably monoxide and everything else, but they did. They survived. So. And we've had other bad explosions there. Decoven or 3 miners killed. So you had to always, being a miner, you learn these things, you try to anyway. keep on your toes. You don't never take the roof, the rib, like a coal rib. You just see a coal rib. Well, it's no problem. It is a problem. Especially the conventional units. Continuous miners, boy, them edges look just like it, perfectly straight and hard. But on a conventional unit, the cutter would cut under it, and the drill, and it'd shoot off. A lot of times you might have an overhang like this. That thing could pop off, And coal weighs 90 pounds per square foot. Just one little square foot of coal weighs 90 pounds. So just think of a big lump of it. Or a big piece of draw slate. These miners, been so many miners killed and maimed by draw slate, falling rock. So there's a lot of hazards down there. You really have to be on guard. You can never let your guard down. You learn over time. I felt comfortable down there, but you just learn with any job. You know where the dangers are, and they still get hurt and they still get killed. Things do happen. Here in Lawrenceville, Kentucky, about a year ago, a continuous miner operator. This is something, just a lot of the equipment now is remote control. This continuous miner weighs 100,000 pounds normally. Huge machine, powerful. And it's operated by a little joystick, okay? The operator, remote control. He stands back as this huge machine is ripping the coal. He stands back at a distance and watches and operates with these little levers. It's just amazing. Well, this guy, this is having quite a bit. He backed the miner up, ribbed himself. He run over himself, crushed him to death. And, 2 years before that, a scoop operator did the same thing, just backed it over top of himself. That happens. And so I don't care how safe you try to be, things happen. And like I said, we were fortunate to camp too. We never had a fatality. We had a lot of injuries. Nobody was ever killed. We did have two guys that were killed. It wasn't in mining. It's when they were putting the slope in back in 1969 right here. A big rock fell and killed two guys, crushed them to death. And we had a guy die of a heart attack, a shooter. Number 4 unit, but it was nothing to do with mining. It was just natural cause. He was sitting on a rib and he just fell over dead. Wasn't hurt. But, that's the way it was. You could always, if you live around a coal mine, you always hear the siren. Ambulances. Always. I've had a few calls from me. So.
In all your years in the mine, was there a cave-in in any areas?
Oh, my goodness. Are you serious? Yeah, hundreds of them. Hundreds of cave-ins. That's part of life.
In part of the...
they're right there where... Yeah, they could be right there where you're mining coal. I never forget that one time. I was fairly new on this particular unit, and I was driving my shuttle car, empty a load of coal, and you always had to, like I say, a wire of roof and rib. And I seen some little specks popping off the roof and falling, little teeny rocks, little barren marbles just popping. So I stopped. You just thought it'd be safe. About that time, the whole intersection fell in. Thousands of tons of rock fell in. It was about 100 feet ahead, and I was headed right toward it. And I just had to see this top working, the little pieces falling rock. So it could fall, but usually when top worked, it would let you know. It would usually pop and crack. It just wouldn't all of a sudden just as quiet as if it didn't happen like that. It always made a little bit of noise to give you a warning to look out and get back. And then we've had some. My last day in the mines there in 1991, what cost me my mining career, was a roof fall. It was down in here. Well, I can't find it. It was down in here. It was number 2 unit, my last unit. And it was the end of shift, and I was always pretty good at mining. I never did force anybody really good. We was in this panel of coal, the worst panel I've ever seen as far as roof conditions and the coal itself, it was really unusual. Coal was usually hard, shiny black, but this coal was light gray and brittle and had a little rock in it, and you could almost take a hand and crush a lump and crush it. This coal, it was just, wasn't like this number 9 here. It was totally different. And toward the end, right at the end of the shift, guys been loading the man trip, the intersection started working. And so I said, God, we got to timber or move the equipment so it don't fall in on. Only two guys stayed, so we started moving equipment, pulling it back, because we knew it was coming in. We wasn't going to stop it. And it was a set of rooms. The rooms aren't important. You can go leave the fall and go around it, unlike the entrance. It's a different ballgame. I won't have time to explain. So it didn't matter if it failed. You just didn't want to get your equipment. So within 5 minutes, here it comes. 70 feet long, 18 feet wide, and 6 feet high. No telling, 100,000 ton of them. I mean, it just all come in one huge blast and concussion. You know, hit the ground, cut the miner cable in two, but it didn't get on the miner. Okay, but it got the cable. The cable's about that big, around 950 volts. So I sent the other two guys around the other side of the fall to timber, try to protect some of the other equipment, because I didn't know where this thing was going. You didn't know. It was just popping and cracking all over the end. Popping. So I was working alone. There was a stack of timber, three cross cuts away, which is 180 feet. And I started packing two timbers at a time, one under each arm, 6 foot long, or 6 foot 6. And they're really heavy. And I already had two backup operations. But I felt I didn't have any choice. I just wanted to run back and forth, set these timbers in front of the ripper head on this miner. And just as I got about that last timber, here she come. That fall come right up toward me, right up to the ripper head on that miner. But where these eight timbers, I guess, were sitting right there. And it stopped that rock fall. It stopped right there in front of the miner. So it didn't get on that. So when the second shift came in, all they had to do was splice this miner cable back together, you know, and back in the coal run. But that run my back. It was on a Friday. That following Monday, I made it, barely made it to work. I had to lay on the rib all that. So that's the way it was. So yeah, we had lots and lots of roof fires. We never had a fatality. Now, our sister mine, Camp One, yes, I know they had one or two, at least two men killed. It fell on the one of them was a boss. Just like me in the shelter, riding along in his little jitney, like a golf car, and fell right on top of it. You know, you're talking thousands of tons of rock here. A terrible sight. Have to be hand loaded off. It's not a mine injury or grievous because of the nature of the equipment. It's just so heavy. It's so daggone easy to get hurt. I would never want, you know, I wouldn't want none of my family or children to ever go on a mine. If they had a choice. You got to have the right personality, disposition, and everything to work down there. There's a lot of guys that have that touch can do great now, you know. But we got a few minutes. You want to fire that thing up?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I get talking about mine, and I don't know when to stop.
Take this off.
Any more questions? Let me go. Any questions?
Anybody got?
Yeah. Yeah, we had a few women working there through the years. I knew all of them. I worked with most of them. In fact, I had women crew members, shuttle car operators, a shooter. And I said in my book, for the most part, they were a lot easier to get along with some of the men I had, you know, for the most part. Of course, having women on the run, it could cause problems. You know, I'm not going to say it wasn't trouble-free. It's like kind of like hating place, maybe. It could be. And in my book, I blamed a lot of it more on the bosses in their positions of authority than the women. You know, they had this authority position, and I guess some of the females might have been attracted to them, and the bosses sure didn't turn them down either. Some of them didn't. But it's just it was a fact of life, and the way it was, but for the most part, they were good miners. They did their job, especially this one female timberman. I was always amazed at her. She was really petite. You know, she didn't 5'4", maybe 100 pounds, but she set heavy timbers as heavy as she was. And she could do her job. Had female shooters, did fine. And if they got behind her, there was always a guy around to catch them up. So... So that's just kind of the way it was. This here is a
This is a shuttle car. This is what hauls coal. This, and that guy there, Hugh Winstead, he's deceased now. He died of cancer a few years ago. Fine feller. But that's one of the newer cars, even though it's not a new one. It doesn't have a canopy, and that tells me it's an older shuttle car. But the operator deck is in the center. So they would haul about 8 tons of coal. You can go ahead. Well, just go ahead. That's the guy. Just standing. These are not the pictures I wanted to show you. The ones I downloaded didn't work. That's just another shuttle car. Yeah, he's up. Yeah, that's upside down. Even though I felt like it down there sometime. That's just a picture of the roof. Just go ahead there. And there. That's just an underground there, section foreman. That's just some guys sitting in what we call the shack. And you can tell this is at the beginning of the shift. The boss must be making the faces because they're all clean. They won't look like that in about an hour. They'll all be black. Just go ahead. That's a guy, you can go ahead, just some guys playing. No, you shouldn't see that one. That's the face boss there on that particular unit right there. And that's the guy there, he's just sitting in the loader canopy there. He died too, heart attack 3 years ago. That's the back of a cutting machine. They're not real great pictures right here. You can go ahead. Okay, it's nothing there. Okay, hold it just a second. This here... Let's see if I can get this thing around. This here is a Joey. It's not a real great picture, but this is a Joey cutting machine. You see this? It looks like we call it a giant chainsaw. This bar extends 9 feet out past the cutter, and that's what cuts under the seam of a pole on a conventional unit. It's about 14 inches wide and 6 inches thick. This is the type of bit that it used right here. Had about 72 of them in this bar here. And this machine was 40 feet long from the tip of this bar. It was huge. So the bag weighed around 40,000 pounds. So it was a massive piece of mining machinery. And it took a lot of skill, more skill to operate this, I always felt, than any other piece of equipment. That's a cutting machine. They're just talking. That's what we call a Jeep. That's a supply Jeep that hauls supplies in and out of the mines and pull man trip trailers for men on the supply roads, things like that. That's a coal drill. I was a coal drill operator for about a year and a half. That's what drills the holes in the face of this. This is the first piece of equipment that goes into the face of the coal. For example, just say this drill. On the unit, just 1, 2, 3, 4. This is like 6 faces right here. You drive these all at one time. They're about 18 feet wide. And of course, there's a 62-inch high coal seam. The coal drill, he would be the first entry. He would come in here and drill 4 holes at the top of the coal and 2 bore holes. If you're looking straight on, it would look like this. Here's the coal face. You drill a hole here, 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 and here, and 2 more breaker holes down here. He would stick a white water dummy in it for the shooter. Then he would pull out and go to the next place. Okay, go to the next one. I think tell them about that. This is a guy putting a pin into the roof. I shouldn't see that. That's a no-no. This is not my unit, by the way. Somebody else. This is another unit. Somebody give me a picture. This is guys horseplaying a lot, constant horseplay. You go ahead. That's the back of coal drill. That's the water dummies that stick in these 6 holes after they drill them. They're white because the cutter operator can see. Okay. This is a Bradish. All of these here, that's why you have hair on the unit. Thousands of them. If you remember the map, that's what these are here. They're concrete Bradishes. That exhaust fan sucks air. It's on the return air system. And these Bradishes keeps it all over here. You have to have 9,000 cubic feet per minute on the return and 12,000 minutes. And you check it with this anemometer. Okay. This is boss, another face boss. You go ahead.
How do you know a face boss? Do they wear any distinguishing?
Well, normally carry safety lights.
Carry the safety.
These federal mine inspectors, fire bosses, But you know, they don't use them anymore. They stopped using these about 3 years ago. And
why?
Well, they just use these electronic devices now that can take oxygen samples, methane, can do it all. But before, they used these to check for methane gas and oxygen. But they're no longer necessary. Of course, these things originated back in the 1700s, because, there'd been many old coal mines in Europe back then. They would send fireballs in to burn off the methane gas that accumulated during the night before. And it was extremely dangerous. And so they would usually use prisoners. They would knock some time off their sentence to go in and burn out the gas. So, I'll get a year off, I'll do it. And a lot of them blow it up, too. But so anyway, they developed this. And this is completely safe in any atmosphere of gas. I don't care what the concentration is. It's got these little gauze. Well, I wish I'd brought my magnet to take it apart. But these little gauze pads, how that works, this flame here, it burns all the time. It's got 784 little holes per square inch. And what this does, this will let this methane get in there, and it will ignite it, okay? But when it tries to, blow up, it won't do it because these little gauzes, it cools the flame when it goes through these little holes. These little streamlets of fire, and it self-extinguishes. So that's why they're safe. And after they invented that, it made all the difference in the world, safety in the coal mines. But they, like I say, they're obsolete now, as is all this. Conventional mining, it's gone. Okay. Here's a shooter right here. I did that for a while, too. Here's his bag. He usually carried 50 sticks of high explosives. Here's his 9-volt shooting battery, his cable, shooting leg wire, what you call it. I was talking about an overhang earlier. You see this one? You see that overhang right there? See it? How that could pop off of there? I saw it when I saw the picture. Man, guy, you ought to be sitting right there. Here's a wing curtain that carries, you're supposed to have 3,000 feet at the face where the equipment's operating. And this is a loader sitting there waiting to go in after he shoots that coal. Okay. This is a two-way, a double. So you see this wire, leg wire running across, these are all panned up. This thing's ready to shoot. Same thing, you're wiring up the double. That's the ball, that's the shooter, and they're getting all the wires, getting all the holes wired to blast. That guy's aiming to break. Okay. This is the coal drill again. You can see this boom, this drill. See, he's sumped up in coal here. He's drilling those holes. So that's what that is. That's what he's doing, drilling holes. All right, was drilling. That's the shooter. Okay. That's the guy on the show car. Now here's a loader. He's going in there. That's what it looks like down here. Dark and dirty and runs it, okay? He's going out there to get to see all this coal on the rear. This place is just shot. He's on his loader. This is after they used it for years. They didn't have canopies. But man, there's so many miners killed on these daggone loaders. They didn't have any canopies on. And they were fully exposed. All they had was a little swivel seat on the side of this daggone thing. And there's so many of them that ribbed themselves and slew around these tracks and get into a rib, crush themselves to death, or a rock would fall out and hit them. It's a very, very dangerous job. So he's loaded. You see the tail. You see the coal? He's dumping coal into the shovel car here. Is what he's doing. Getting a load of coal. Right on the 7 to 8 ton of coal. That's just another close-up picture of Ricky Nichols. He's loading this fall of coal. About 25 ton in the fall. Okay? No, just two guys. Nothing more. That's a mechanic. Okay? That's a good picture of a loader right there. And I'd say these are obsolete. Thing of the past. My unit had the last conventional unit which used this type of equipment. You see these gathering arms here? These things pivoted like that. These arms would do like this. Just scoop up the coal. You wouldn't believe how efficient they were. They could really scoop it up. So that's what that is right there. Fly man. There's an ambulance, by the way, and that's just baseballs and the loader operator at the beginning of the shift. At the back of the coal drill, you see he's got his boom up and he's building. And that's a cutting machine operator. Man, the machine I was telling you about up at the big bar, it was a hard machine to operate, awkward. And it took a lot of skill to run one of these things professionally. It wasn't easy. Okay. another picture of the operator on this cutting machine. There's a shooter. After this drill cut, see that cutter was going in there. He stuck that mark right here. He cut it all the way across to the bottom of the coal. Okay, right up at the bottom of the coal seam where it touched the fire clay, he would cut across with that bar. So, just shut it all down. Just three guys on the ground. That was a high place where the roof had fallen out. Okay, there might be some pictures in this old gym. Okay? See, it wouldn't all work down there. Roll the drill, man. Okay, so he was drilling a hole into the roof there, 4 foot hole for the pin. Cutter operator. It's a pin, man. Take the break. And, okay, just keep going.
Not much
here. A lot of horseplay there. I don't want to describe what he's doing. That guy's sleeping. Okay. A lot of that went on. Now, here's a fairly good picture of the cutting machine. You can see this bar? This is, see the bits in it? These bits here, plumb bobs, replace these bits. These took forever to change. 72 bits, and you had to take each one of them out. These set screws, one at a time. It took a lot of time. These were a lot quicker. These were knockout bits. And this boom on this thing is amazing what it could do. It would turn all the way up 90 degrees, either way, up and down, sideways. It would do anything. You could do anything you wanted to. All hydraulics. Okay? Let's go here. Looks like they're waiting on fall toll to be shot there. Okay. This mechanic had just spliced the cable to see the butane tank there. Okay. There's another good, you see they're changing bits on this cutter bar here. So you need to change bits. Car driver. It's Harold Beaver. Harold, I didn't even work for him for years. He died a few years ago of a black run on track pictures. Just another cut of flex. And you can see what it was like down to the roof. He's the pin with the hole of the roof.
Not much room down there.
That's more than fine. He gets used to it. Car driver. This is one picture I really needed to show y'all, and I like that, man. That's a good shot of the cutting machine. But I'd say these are obsolete. We got that continuous man as the first one, cost $1 million. And in 1985, I made a venture to replace all these convention units. They were a lot safer because they had these huge scrubbers, and they sucked this dust in them. I mean, they had this big hood, it held a ripper head, and it had this high volume fan on it. It sucked all this dust in at the face and ended it out the back of the machine, just a damp mist. So health-wise, as far as breathing can do, it's much, much better. Of course, you still had to watch your flow dust on your spirals, because in the winter months, the lines would dry out so fast. It would get so dusty down there. And as I told you before, flow dust was extremely dangerous, more so than methane in the water. So you always had to keep these haulage roads wet, soaking wet. So a lot of times it was muddy. It's cold grill. You see all the assortment of levers. Another branch. That's where I used to stop now. Come out of the mines, out of the slopes right there and dump right there. So.
Is there still a lot of coal down there?
There sure is. In fact, not too far from where I live, where my wife and I live, where we're building that. The last coal company is putting new mines in. In fact, they just started running coal here a few weeks ago. It's going to be one of the largest in the United States. It's going to have 8 continuous mining units. They're going to have a split. They're going to mine 11 and 9 at the same time, 4 units in each, for around 600 miners. It's a huge complex, $280 million investment. And so it'll be one of the biggest around. But I still wanted to stay by mine to make money. It's just so expensive to mine coal. It's just the cost. You wouldn't believe it. What it cost. Back in 1984, our cost to mine coal was $48 a ton. If you read my book, you'll find out what happened and the reason. It's some of the reasons for it, because there's some illegal stuff going on there higher up. But anyway, we got a new superintendent. Bruce from 48, he got it down to the $16 cost. So.
Maybe we'll pause now and get some questions.
Like I say, I can go on forever.
Questions from the audience, and then we'll do our door prize, and we have a copy of Mike's book to give away tonight. Yeah. Everyone in for the door prize?
I wanted to ask you about your father and why they came over from France, and that story.
Well, my father, he was 17 years of age, and he lived through World War One there in France. Of course, you know how horrible it was there. Trench warfare, millions of people died, and he saw his own uncle hang himself, you know, because of trench warfare. He had emotional damage. He found him hanging in the barn. So, and he was living on the farm there, and he was just looking for a new way of life, even at that early age. And he was a smart fellow. Of course, then he had learned to speak English, talking with American GIs. And so he got a job in Lyon as a bellboy, Hotel Royale, which is still in operation today. It's a beautiful hotel downtown Lyon. But anyway, the American Consul General, which is the same thing as Ambassador, David Herrick, was staying in that hotel, and he got the number of calls. So one thing left another, and he asked him if he'd like to come to America. He said, well, most certainly. And so he hooked him up with the Browns in Louisville, the Brown Forman Distillery Corporation. We went to Paris and met with the Browns. They liked my dad. Brought him to the USA with him. They were over there trying to sell whiskey, the whiskey product, because it was during Prohibition. And so, but anyway, they brought dad back to America with him. They lived in their state in Louisville. They sent him to college and graduated from Spencerian Business College. He did go back and do a 2-year duty in the French Army, because if you didn't do that, you could never go home again. They'd arrest you. So he went back and did that. So the worst mistake they made in his life. Dad just didn't like the military. He wasn't a military type guy. But anyway, he come back and finished his education, got a job at Uniontown Lock and Dam on construction in 1924. And from there, you know, he met my mother, and 6 sons later, and 1 daughter died. You know, that's the way that happened. And I'm really proud of my French heritage. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate that.
This is the centennial history of the university, and knowing your close affiliation. On behalf of WKU Libraries and Kentucky Museum, I want to again thank Mike for a very long drive and a very entertaining and fascinating look at coal mining. What really unique look I think we've never had before. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming up. We hope you'll join us again in our series on Peggy the 29th. Of October, when Linwood Montell will be at the Kentucky Building talking about tales from Kentucky funeral parlors. So, a little spookiness for Halloween. Again, thank you and good evening.
Thank you.